Greetings, all your 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue looking at some reports here on the economy. The most notable this past week, of course, have been the Consumer Price Index and the Producer Price Index reports. And then if we have time, also comment on another report called SLOOS, which is an acronym, S-L-O-O-S, for Senior Loan Officers Opinion Survey. And that has to do with the banks. In other words, these are the lenders, or businesses, corporations, mostly big corporations, and they report on whether there is a growing or falling, I would say, demand for loans by businesses, which is an indicator of what's going on in terms of the slowing of the economy. Okay, so let's proceed here. Let's turn to the inflation indexes. That's the Consumer Price Index, which came out. And that was followed by the Producer Price Index. Producer prices, in other words, prices that are rising for businesses before they actually sell their goods and services. All right, so let's start with the Consumer Price Index here for this past week. Very interesting. Came out, I think, on Tuesday. Thursday was the Producer Price Index, and what did we get? Well, we got a 4.9% annual increase over the last 12 months of inflation. Well, you know, the Biden administration is really spinning this, saying that, well, that's the lowest in 2 years. You know, last summer it was 9.1%, so they've come down to 4.9%, and that's the lowest in 2 years. In other words, we're making great progress. Well, compare it to last month, the previous month, March. And what do we get for March? 5%. Okay, so we went from 5% to 4.9%. And that's a big deal after raising interest rates to over 5.25%. That's a big deal. That's statistically insignificant change, 4.9 from 5.0. And more important is the fact that core inflation, not all items, but core. Core inflation is everything except food and energy. That's what we call core inflation in the CPI index. Was 5.5%, and it's been 5.5% since the beginning of the year. And actually, even back last year, the core was around 5.5%. 9%, all items, core, 5.5% for almost a year now. Chronic, stuck. They can't get it down below 5.5. Maybe they'll get it down a little bit more. But in other words, they raised interest rates at the most rapid and historic pace, so high that they're precipitating a crisis in the regional banking system. Over the past year, they started last March, the Fed started last March, raising interest rates, and they haven't been able to impact core inflation at all. Think about that. Except for energy and food, which is what they call headline inflation, all items plus energy and food, energy being mostly gasoline, some heating oil, electricity, natural gas, whatever. Yeah, they brought that down. Why? Because the global price of crude oil has come down. Because the global economy is weakening, largely or significantly because of war and sanctions. So, yeah, the economy globally is weakening. You know, we hear a lot about what the administration is doing to weakened the U.S. economy, but not much about how its policies are weakening the global economy. So virtually all of the shakeout in inflation has been due to declining energy prices, mostly crude oil prices. Yeah, that's been most of it, and food. Okay, food was really surging last year, and the food prices have come down. So why have they come down? Well, there's a couple of reasons. We'll get into those. But food and energy have come down. That's what's been shaken out from the 9% to the 5.5%. You know, so about 3.5% of the CPI index has been reduced due to the rate hikes. No, it's been due to the slowing global economy, mostly. So, you know, headline inflation has come down because of the Fed interest rate hikes. Headline has come down, but core has not. All items, core, other than energy and food. Okay, so what does that mean? What that means is the Fed interest rate hikes aren't having the effect that the Fed had intended. If core inflation is stuck at 5.5% here, not just the last 2 months, but chronically for a longer period of time, that means Fed rate hikes aren't impacting the economy in terms of inflation. In terms of goods, in other words, discrete things sold, i.e., you know, energy prices, oil prices, gasoline prices, food. Yeah, okay. That's having an impact. That's how we get from 9 to 5, 4.9, whatever. That's how you get there. 5.5% or 5.5% interest rates. But it's not shaking out the real chronic stuck prices, the core. You know, and if you listen to Jerome Powell, the chair of the Fed, ever since late last year, every time he raises rates and he does a press conference and they ask him questions, every time he says, well, the real problem here is services prices. In other words, core prices. Most of the core is services. He says, we got to precipitate, we got to get more unemployment for workers working in the service industries, because prices aren't coming down in services, so we gotta shake it out by focusing on dampening demand by causing unemployment and layoffs in the services sector. That will bring service prices down. Not happening. It's been a whole year. What's happening is that these interest rates have reached the level that it's precipitating financial instability in the regional banking system. And that's continuing, by the way. We'll talk about that a little bit. So it's a failure. Fed policy is a failure. The Fed says they're going to get interest rates, inflation rate down to 2%. Well, it's a long way from 2%. 5% is a long way from 2% after you've hiked interest rates over 5%. What do you got to do? Raise interest rates to 10% to shake it out down to 2% inflation rate? Yeah, probably. Interest rates would probably have to go to 8 to 10%. That's the Fed base benchmark rate, policy rate, they call it. Yeah, it would have to go to 8 to 10% to precipitate a deep, deep recession that would bring prices down to 2%. You know, during COVID, when we had the deep contraction and recession, yeah, prices got down to 2%. That's what it took to get prices down to the Fed's goal of 2%. So that 2% goal is nonsense. The Fed will never get it down to 2%, and the Fed, unless it precipitates a big recession again, which may happen, That's the only way to get it down 2%. So I, in the long run, the Fed's going to change that 2% goal. It's going to raise it, I think, maybe 3, 3.5. That's not yet, but it'll do that. Or maybe it'll just keep the 2% and let's have a very deep recession. Yeah, because that's the only way you're going to get down 2%. Otherwise, as we've seen, 5, 5.5% is core inflation, and it's stuck at 5, 5.5%. That's not a good report. That's not a good inflation report. That's not a good CPI report. And to spin saying, oh, we went from 5 to 4.9%, well, that's just political bullshit. Because the situation with inflation is chronic. It's stuck. And if you look at the CPI, that's the case. Now, actually, it's higher than 4.95%. Let me explain why. Just one reason why. There's several reasons why it's actually higher, but here's the big reason in last month's numbers. Last month, the big cause, the biggest contributor of core inflation was what they call shelter. Now, shelter is cost of homes, home prices, and also rents. In the U.S., you have about 50 million owner-occupied homes, called units, 50 million owned units with mortgages, right? And then you have about 50 million rental units. Now, rents go up for true renters, but the U.S. has this oxymoron category that it calls owner-imputed rents, owner-occupied rents. In other words, homeowners charge themselves for rent. That's what's in the calculations of the rents. Now, what they charge themselves is minimal, according to the methodology, minimal rent increases. So if you take 50 million charging themselves minimal rent increases, well below the actual rental increases, and then you have actual rent increases on 50 million, guess what happens? The actual rent increases for both is boosted by a factor of 2. In other words, you can assume that the rent number is probably twice as high as they're reporting. And last month, that was the big contributor, even with their reduced estimation, to core inflation. So core inflation is actually more because the rents are actually higher than they're reporting because they dampened and reduced them by this nonsense imputed owner-occupied rents. Now, there's a lot of that nonsense going on in the consumer price index and all the price indexes. There are a lot of these methodologies that really come up with a statistic, a number that is different than what real people are paying for. You see, a statistic is not the actual data. It's you take the raw data and you do a methodology manipulation of it. And that comes out, that's a statistic. That's the definition of statistic. It's not the real thing. It's a manipulation of the real thing. Now, one of the big manipulations is seasonality adjustments. And every spring, when they start producing vegetables and fruits and so forth in the economy, there's a big seasonality adjustment that reduces the cost of food. The seasonality adjustment is a statistic. It may not be what you're paying at the grocery store. And, of course, that's what's happening here in the April numbers, which lowers it. The numbers for fruits and vegetables and milk and eggs and so forth decreased in the spring, as they always do, right? Spring harvest, whatever. So the price of food came down. That has to be factored into what we're talking about when we say 4.9%, 5%. But the problem is not in all items, in other words, headline inflation, including food and energy. The problem is in the core, everything else except food and energy. And if you look at the report, used car prices and housing prices, recreation, personal services, and so forth, all rose in April compared to March. So we have a number of factors, of items, that are actually rising in April. Not everything is falling. Some things that are falling are because of statistical methodologies. But the worst of that is rents, which is the biggest factor here last month. Anybody knows, you know, who's had their rent increase, that it's not rising by 4 or 5%, right? When they raise the rents. But when you have rental increases, when you have so many people who are renting, 50 million, right? And you have so many units that are renting. So let's say 10 million rise by 20%, your rent increased 20-25%, right? And then the rest of them, there is no rise, or it's a less. You know, you average out such a large number, and it comes out pretty small. And then it gets even smaller when you add 50 million imputed owner-occupied rents. You see, these are some of the games that are played in how they calculate the CPI. The bottom line is, you know, one, CPI core, chronic, stuck between 5 and 6% for months now. Interest rates can't get it down unless they come much higher, which they won't. But that's the key figure here, the key number to keep in mind. That's why when you read reports in the media, the press, you know, they report this month's CPI, they're all over the place. You know, one time they say, oh, it's come down, big deal, 4.9%. Oh, but the pressure is still strong, you know, and then they, you know, this and that, and they cover. If you read these reports, you know, in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you say, well, wait a minute, you know, is it a good thing or not a good thing? Because they're saying some things are good, some things are not. That's because it's mixed. It's mixed. Inflation is still chronic. Chronic. And it's going to remain chronic. And the longer it remains chronically high in the 4 to 5% range here, the more what they call inflationary expectations get anchored. In other words, they get cemented in. People are expecting 4 to 5%, and they act in certain ways that ensure that it's going to be 4 to 5%. They start buying things now because they're going to go up. You know, I need to buy it now. And businesses do the same thing. Inflationary expectations, if you look at the various surveys, Michigan survey and so forth, are stuck also between 4.5% and 5.5% for consumers and businesses. Businesses expect even higher inflation to continue, around 5.5% to 6%. Consumers around 4.5% to 5%. So inflationary expectations have anchored this 5.5% core price number, price increase number, have anchored it. That's a problem. How you get inflationary expectations, the psychology out of the system, is very difficult. Now, another factor why it's going to remain high is unit labor costs. All businesses have unit labor costs. In other words, what's the cost of labor per item sold, whether it's a discrete good or a particular service? That's called unit. The unit of sales, the cost of labor per unit of whatever is sold. Right? Now, unit labor costs are determined by two things. One, wage changes, and productivity changes, those two. Now, wages have risen somewhat for occupations at the higher end, income end. Those at the median and below, well, very low, they've raised because some states have raised their minimum wages. But for most of the median, wages have not risen, but they have risen for the top 10-20% of the labor force. Okay, so wages have contributed some to unit labor costs, but not for most of the working class. But productivity has collapsed. Yeah, last week we talked about that. Remember the productivity numbers, the worst since 1948? Five consecutive quarters of decline for the first time in U.S. history. Productivity has declined. And that drives up unit labor costs. And businesses pass those on to consumers if they can. If you're a monopolistic corporation, you can. And you will pass it on. And a good example is what the four or five big cereal bakery goods companies, you know, they have a monopolistic influence over their prices. They can raise them regardless of supply or demand. All right. And bakery goods have continued to go up, even though certain food items have gone down. Yeah. So, corporate price gouging by monopolist corporations will continue. It was really intense last year, but it's still continuing in certain industries right now. So unit labor cost, productivity collapse, inflationary expectations, corporate price gouging, these are all forces that are continuing in the economy, and why core inflation is not going to get down very much. You know, I've been saying it's going to be chronic 4-5%. They can get it down a little bit more. Now, if they have a deep recession by the end of the year, then yeah. Then they can take it out on the backs of the working class and get prices down. But, you know, Fed Chair Powell keeps saying, no, you know, we're going to have a soft landing. Well, the markets don't think so. The markets, you know. I like that phrase, the markets, as if they weren't people, as if they weren't big capitalist investors. You know, those are, quote, the markets. But we just call it the markets, you know, to cover up that these are actually people, you know, of a certain class that are investing in the financial assets of stocks and bonds and all that stuff. Well, okay. So, yeah, the markets don't believe the Fed. The markets believe that by the end of summer, the Fed is going to have to start and will start lowering interest rates. Yeah. The Fed is signaling that maybe, not likely, but maybe one more 0.25% hike, and then they're going to stand pat for the rest of the year. They're not going to lower rates throughout the year. Well, the markets don't believe that. The markets believe that come September, October, there's going to be rate cuts, and that by the end of the year, the Fed will have reduced its interest rates by 75 basis points, which is 0.75%. You know, it's at 5.25 now. They're saying it'll be at 4.5 by the end of the year. Now, to get that kind of reduction in interest rates, you have to have very clear, significant job losses. You know, we're still growing jobs of, you know, 200,000-300,000 here a month. Now, that's overestimated, as I've been saying in previous shows for various reasons, but we're still getting that. But to get a 75% basis point decline by the end of the year, you're going to have to start seeing unemployment, in other words, job losses of 100,000 to 200,000 a month starting in September. So the markets, investors are saying that's coming. They believe it. The Fed says, no, you know, for public consumption, that's not where we're going. But think about it. You know, the Fed can't say, yeah, we're going to have a recession, a deep one. No, the government bureaucrats never say that. They can't, because then that would exacerbate the likelihood. So they always sing a happy tune here. They spin it. And I think the Fed is spinning it, because, you know, by the fall, that's like 18 months And that means that the interest rate hikes will really start biting by the end of summer. It takes 18 months. It's a lag of 18 months from the time they start. The Fed started in March of 22, right? We're about a year into that. But if economists are right, it takes about 18 months for it to really impact the economy, then we're looking at about September for it really to start biting and causing layoffs. So are we going to have a soft landing according to the Fed? Or will we have a hard landing according to, quote, the markets? Well, I tend to believe the latter. Although they're not always right either. But this is going to be an interesting 6 months here over the summer. Will core inflation continue to remain at 5.5% as it has almost for a year? If so, will the Fed raise rates once again? Further? I don't think that's going to happen because the regional banking system's too shaky. You know, we've had three big banks. These aren't small community banks, you know, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature, and now First Republic, most recently, all collapsed. And there's about a dozen others, according to Moody's rating service, that, you know, are candidates for the next in line. And I think the most next in line is PacWest Bancorp, which yesterday lost another 20% in this stock price. You know, the collapsing stock price is an indication of the bank in trouble. The share price is down to around a little over $4 a share. You know, which is, it's following the same trajectory that First Republic did. So I think that, you know, we're going to, deposits will continue to outflow. And if the Fed raises rates further, it's going to exacerbate this and accelerate this. Now, what is the Fed doing about the regional banking crisis? It's throwing a pot of money at it, as it always does when there's a banking crisis. You know, in 2008-09, the Fed threw $4 trillion at it. And the banks were in trouble. But then we got this strange policy development when COVID hit in March, April of 2020. The Fed threw another $5 trillion. The banks weren't in trouble then. But the Fed, for the first time ever, threw $5 trillion of free money, virtually, drove interest rates down to zero, initiated special lending programs, and threw money at the banks to keep them from crashing. Well, they weren't going to crash, but in any event, $5 trillion more went out so that the Fed balance sheet, as it's called, its debt, now amounted to $9 trillion. And then the Fed last year, when it started raising rates, said they're always going to try to pull some of this money back, which every time it says that, it never succeeds. But anyway, and they started pulling, you know, per month, $50 to $100 billion out of the economy that they had thrown in of that $9 trillion. Okay, so it came down $500-600 billion. Over the course of 22. And then the most recent banking crisis hit, and the Fed immediately in March threw $400 billion at it. Once again, reversed everything it had done in the previous year. Threw another four, and this time the banks were in trouble, of course, the regional banks. $400 billion in 2 weeks. And ever since then, quietly, the Fed and the FDIC have provided 70 to 90 billion, latest week is $92 billion to bail out these banks before they go belly up. A lot of them. So a lot of these banks, since the regional banking crisis occurred, a lot of these banks have been borrowing like hell from the Fed through its special facility it has what it calls its discount window, where banks can go and borrow too, below rates. So, in other words, the flood is continuing. The Fed is desperately trying to offset any of the crises that erupted here with the regional banking system in March. And we'll continue to do that. So, you know, if it's like 70, 90 billion throughout April and into May here, you know, that's like we're close to $1 trillion again in the last couple of months of the Fed injecting free money into these banks to keep them from going belly up. But we still have depositor outflow from the region, a lot of these regional banks. Depositors aren't taking any chance. If they see a problem, they're pulling their money out and moving it. Where? Well, they're moving it to the big banks or the money market funds, you know, like Fidelity, but they're moving it to Chase and Wells and Citi and B of A, Bank of America. That's where they're moving it. So these big banks have got a big windfall of deposits. They're sitting on fat city, so fat that the government is now proposing to raise the fees that banks pay to put money into the FDIC that bails out banks, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. They're the ones that come in and bailed out Silicon Valley Bank and so forth, right? So to ensure that they have the ammunition to bail out more banks, they're raising regional banks. They're raising the fee cost on the big banks to put money into that pot. And the big banks, of course, are complaining. They want to just, you know, absorb that windfall of depositors coming to them. So this thing is not over. The banking crisis is not over. And what happens will depend a lot on whether the Fed raises interest rates further and whether it keeps this free money flow going into these banks. We'll see. But it's an interesting juncture here over the summer. This is going to continue. The Fed is, walking a tightrope here. You know, we got the chronic inflation, 5.5%, that's not coming down without a deep recession. Raising more rates will cause a deep recession, but raising rates more will have unknown effects on the banking system. You know, Fed policy, interest rate, monetary policy, has hit a wall. There's a big contradiction here, whether it can continue that policy. And at the same time, you know, the regular government here outside the Fed, you know, Congress, is really debating on how much to cut social spending. You know, that's what's really going on. All this deficit debt, you know, raise the debt ceiling is just a political dance between the two wings of the corporate party, America, a.k.a. Republicans and Democrats, right? It's just a dance that they do. They will kick that can down the road, I predict. Sometime in June, they'll kick it down the road to probably September, October, because that's when the discussions will go into high gear over the budget for the coming year, 24. You see, the budget starts on October 1st. So they'll be discussing and passing the 24 budget, 2024, which begins October 1st to September 30th of 24. That's when they'll really be debating the social program cuts. I think this is all a political dance between McCarthy and Biden. They will kick the can down the road. That will happen. It's always happened 78 times already. You know, why do you think there won't be a 79th? They'll do that. And then the real intensive cost-cutting will occur back in the fall. Okay, but, you know, there's a big PR push by the Biden administration now, you know, bringing out Janet Yellen's Treasury Secretary in order to really put pressure. Oh, the sky's going to fall if we don't extend the debt ceiling. You know, oh, it's going to be a crash of the economy. We got to pay our debts and so forth. Well, they could drag that out at least another 3 months. You know, they got all kind of cubby holes and stashed cash here in the government, and they can continue payments. But I don't think that's going to happen. McCarthy's not in strong enough position with votes in the House that he can buck this. He's looking for PR here for the Republican Party. And, of course, Biden is doing the same. So on the fiscal policy side, you know, we got focus on deficit, social program spending, because they're not going to cut defense and war. They're going to keep throwing money at Ukraine. Yeah, already over $200 billion spent. You know, they'll spend at least another $100 billion this year, at least. You know, depending on what happens here with the offenses there in Ukraine, which are just now being launched, who knows? But the U.S. is all in already, and it's not going to back out, providing whatever it needs to provide Ukraine from collapsing. Because the U.S. has such strong position in Ukraine economically. You know, back in 2014, Victoria Nuland, who was the Undersecretary of State for the U.S. for Eastern Europe, you know, and played the key role in engineering the coup d'etat there in 2014. Immediately after, she was appointed by the Ukrainian parliament as the economic czar for Ukraine. And that's when the floodgates opened, when she was economic czar, and all these U.S. companies just flooded into Ukraine. And they're all over the place now. Just look at the chambers of commerce for a lot of the secondary cities in Ukraine. And you will see a whole list of American companies who are now members of the chambers of commerce of all these cities, you know, urban areas in Ukraine. So the U.S. has penetrated economically Ukraine, and they bought up a lot of companies. And the U.S. is keeping its currency afloat by making sure the IMF gives Ukraine $13 billion, which, by the way, is a violation of IMF mission statement, because they're not supposed to, by their charter, to give money to any country that's at war. But they're doing it anyway, because the IMF is run by the U.S., you know. And so that's exactly what's happening here. The U.S. is propping up Ukraine, and the IMF is helping out, and the U.S. has penetrated and has deep economic interests already in Ukraine. That's why it's not going to back out of Ukraine. So that spending is going to continue by Congress for Ukraine. The big question is how far will the Europeans go along with continued spending, right? Which means how far will the Germans and French go along, because the other economies are economically insignificant in Eastern Europe. Okay, so the point is that fiscal spending, the debt ceiling, could be resolved easily by, all right, let's cut back all this extra spending on the Pentagon, which is now $858 billion, latest budget, which is not total U.S. defense spending, because a lot of defense spending is in other departments, as I've said, Energy Department, Veterans Department, so forth. And actually, the U.S. is spending on defense about somewhere between 1.1 and 1.3 trillion. I've seen estimates even up to 1.4 trillion, which means about half of all discretionary spending in the U.S. is now military spending. Yeah. Well, you could cut that and solve your much of your deficit and debt ceiling problem. You wouldn't have to worry about debt ceiling, because you'd just cut the spending. Or you could raise taxes. You know, deficits, 60% of deficits are due because due to a lack of tax revenue. It's a tax problem. And, of course, ever since Trump's massive tax cut, $4 trillion plus in 2018, they've taken a lot of money out of the taxation. Right? There was an interesting report here. Let's see if I can remember it. I don't remember the source, but there was a report that looked at GDP, tax rates and tax revenue, U.S., as a percent of GDP. Let me see if I can find this here. I provided a tweet. You know, if you want to find my day-to-day commentary on daily economic events, just follow me on Twitter, at Dr. Jack Rasmus here. Let's see if I can find that here, because it's very interesting. Oh, gee, a lot of stuff here on the Consumer Price Index here in the last couple of days. Oh, here it is. A CBO, Congressional Budget Office, you know, not a left-leaning source, a study released last week shows that federal government corporate tax revenues, corporate tax revenues as a percent of GDP from 1980 to 2017 remained at about 1.7% of GDP, U.S. GDP. In other words, the total amount of corporate tax revenues was constant, did not, as a percent of GDP, did not rise. It was all kept at 1.7%. Now, probably less than 1.7% after Trump's 2018 tax cut, because this statistic is from 1980 to 2017, right? But, in contrast, corporate profits as a percent of GDP rose from 7.9% to 10.9% by 2017. So, to sum up here, profits are rising as a percent of total GDP, but government corporate tax revenues are stagnant as a percent of GDP. 1.7% revenues, corporate tax revenues, and an increase of 7.9 to 10.9% for corporate profits as a percent of GDP. So profits are rising, but they're not being taxed, according to that rise in profits. Yeah, well, no wonder. You know, you cut taxes for $4 trillion in 2018, and you cut taxes since 2001 by $15 trillion. Yeah, that's the figure. You add up Bush tax cuts and Obama tax cuts and Trump tax cuts. And, of course, in 2020, we had more tax cuts for businesses, small businesses in particular. You know, you add it up, it's $15 trillion in tax cuts. And over that same two decades, the U.S. spent roughly $7 trillion on wars. Well, that's $22 trillion right there. I mean, if you didn't have that, there would be no discussion about debt ceilings. Now, they're not going to raise tax revenues on corporations and investors. That's very clear, you know. Very clear. The Democrats included. They don't want to reverse those Trump tax cuts. They talk about it, yeah, but it's all PR marketing stuff. When it comes down to it, when they have a chance to do it, they don't do it. You know, because the corporations are running the Democratic Party, too. This is the power behind the scene here. You know, the leaders of the party, you know, some of them you don't even hear about, are determining its policy direction. And they don't want to raise taxes either. And if tax revenues are 60% of the deficit, well, you're writing off 60% of what you could do. And if, you know, another 20% of the 40 left is war spending, and they don't want to do anything about that, you only got 20%. left to deal with to cut. Yeah. So forget it. They're not going to reduce deficit spending, and especially when we go into a deep recession here, you know, recessions that take the biggest whack out of the deficit. So if we're in a deep recession by the end of the year, as the markets think, well, then what does that mean? That means the deficit and debt is going to go up even more, even faster, which is going to put a hell of a lot of pressure, if they're continuing a war, on cutting social programs. Watch it. Big austerity coming. Big austerity programs, proposals coming. Yeah. Now, it'll be in the election year, so they'll probably backload it after the election. Yeah, starting in 2025. And that will include Social Security, by the way. But even though Social Security spending and revenues have nothing to do with the budget, that's totally outside the budget. It's got its own revenue source, the payroll tax, right? And its own spending is separate from the budget, the regular government budget, you know. But they like to lump them together when they talk about it. Anyway, you know, that's the Fed fiscal policy, monetary policy picture. And to me, it looks like U.S. capitalist fiscal monetary policy is in deep trouble. We talked about how monetary policy, the Fed, can't get inflation down without a deep, deep recession, how raising interest rates now exacerbates a fragile regional banking system. Even if they wanted to raise rates, they may get the worst of both here, because the banking crisis is not over, and the next shoe to fall here will be the commercial real estate sector. Commercial real estate, what is that? That's office buildings, malls, right? Factories, resorts, hotels, and so forth. That's commercial real estate. And two sectors are in deep trouble in that. Two sectors. One is office buildings, where you have incredible lack of vacancy now, or excess vacancy, lack of businesses in buildings, particularly in the big cities. You know, San Francisco, New York, and places like that, you have a lot of vacancy now. And these companies that own this commercial real estate are going to be in deep trouble, because at the end of the year, they have to roll over their existing debt, and they got a lot of junk debt, high interest rate debt, and they may not be able to refinance it. And if that happens, you're going to see some of these commercial real estate companies go bankrupt. And who invests in commercial real estate? Well, your regional banks. Yes, they're like 20-25% exposed to commercial real estate. So if that sector goes belly up at the end of the year when we fall into a deeper recession, then guess what? The banks tied to them are going to go belly up too. And you're going to have more First Republics and Silicon Valley banks, right? Right. Up to now, the crisis in regional banking is because they've gotten overextended due to the tech bubbles and crypto bubbles. These banks, they got in trouble. They overinvested in those bubbles in 2021-22. And the bubble's gone bust, and now they're holding the bag. They overinvested. Well, why did they overinvest? Well, that brings us back to the Fed, you know, and regulations. They were totally deregulated back in 2017-18, regional banks, right? Which meant that the regional banks could loan out virtually all of their deposits into high-risky investments and keep only minimal reserves on hand. Yeah, Silicon Valley Bank only had 1% reserves. it had invested the rest of it, so that when depositors said, we want our money back, they didn't have it. And they quickly tried to issue stock to raise capital, money. That went bust. Then they quickly tried to sell corporate bonds, bank bonds. That went bust, and they were taken over. Well, that's the same scenario. The regional banks were allowed to keep minimal reserves on hand. You know, compare that to Citibank, which keeps 20 to 25% reserves on hand. The regional banks had nothing on hand, virtually, because they weren't regulated. You know, and the government knew this. The FDIC and government agencies knew the situation and did nothing about it. Politically, they couldn't. Yeah. And, of course, deregulation meant that a lot of the weapons that they might have, they didn't have. That was one of the problems. It wasn't the whole problem of why these regional banks went under, but deregulation enabled the crash. And the fact that they kept virtually nothing in reserves for when people wanted their money, they didn't have it. Yeah. See, that's the problem with the capitalist banking system. It's called fractional banking system. Right? People put their money into these banks. It becomes the bank money when they do it. Right? And the banks can do whatever they want with it. And they just keep a small amount as reserves in case depositors want their money back. And when times are good and depositors don't want their money back and it looks like the bank's doing okay, then it's not a problem. Fractional reserve is not a problem. It fuels a lot of expansion, more loans, except in the last 20 years, a lot of these loans go to speculating in stock and bond and derivative markets. So it doesn't produce, the loans don't really produce real economic growth. That's a problem. Okay, so, as long as the depositors don't say we want our money back, you can keep virtually nothing on hand. But when they do, you're in trouble. And that's exactly what's happened. That's the problem with the fractional banking system. They should be keeping on hand, you know, 10, 20%. Then they wouldn't have this problem. But they're allowed to keep virtually nothing on hand. You know? Okay, and well, we've gone over the whole thing with Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic, you know, why they collapsed here. But that's one of the factors. They don't have enough cushion. They don't have enough reserves. Government lets them go. And then, you know, the fact that they invested a lot of it in shaky stuff that goes bust, like commercial real estate going to go bust here by the end of the year. Woo. That will shift us into a total new phase of the banking crisis, should it happen. And we will be seeing chronic inflation at the time and rapidly growing unemployment at the time. I'm talking about September, October, November of this year. That's when the crunch is going to come. You know, what happens over the summer is will tell us how soon and how deep the crisis will be. I don't think I mentioned the producer price index, which underlies the consumer price index. But you know, if you look at the producer price index, it actually increased in April compared to March, which is another factor why inflation in consumer prices will remain chronically around 5%. You know, proofs of price index, the pressure behind it is still there, still growing. And you have inflationary expectations anchoring, which I said, and you have productivity, falling unit labor costs, and pass-through occurring. All those reasons, major reasons, why inflation is not going to be reduced significantly over the next several months, unless we fall off the cliff into a deep recession, which the Fed may push us into, regardless. We'll see. But that's where we're going. And what it means is the Fed and monetary policy is between a rock and a hard place. Contradictions have gotten so strong that monetary policy, the preferred policy vehicle, the capitalist in the 21st century, is not working very well. It's not working very well. As we're seeing, it's not bringing down inflation very well. It's precipitating banking instability in the process. So when monetary policy tries to dampen the economy, slow it down, as we're seeing it's trying to do now, it's not very efficient or effective, right? We're stuck with 5%. We're stuck with a banking crisis. And we've raised, even though we've raised interest rates the most rapid pace here, and I don't know how long, and the Fed cannot raise it any further to bring down inflation without precipitating more banking instability. You know, so that's an inefficiency. It's ineffective. It's hit a wall in dampening the economy. Similarly, vice versa, flip it around, it hit a wall in stimulating the economy. Evidence of that? Well, go back to March 2020, when the Fed dumped $5 trillion into the economy. What did we get? We didn't get much of a economic growth. If you look at the first full year after COVID, which was 2022, first full year, that's, you know, when you're in an 18-month lag after the $5 trillion injection, right, should have produced significant economic growth. As I said before, what was the real GDP between December 31st, 2021 and December 31st, 2022? How much real economy growth did we get? 1% GDP growth. That's all. From December to December, 1% for $5 trillion monetary stimulus. Now, don't tell me that monetary policy as a stimulus to the economy is not dead. $5 trillion and we get a 1% growth? And now flip it around. We're trying to dampen the economy with monetary policy. We got a record pace of interest rate hikes, and we're still stuck at 5.5% core inflation and a banking crisis about to get worse. Don't tell me it's not broken. Monetary policy is not broken when it comes to dampening the economy. Yeah, it's broken in both directions. It can't stimulate it very well, and it can't slow it very well. And that's where we are in the 21st century. U.S. capitalist monetary policy is virtually dead in the water, in my opinion. It can't perform what theoretically it's supposed to do, stimulate the economy and slowing the economy without exacerbating contradictions and crises. And that's the reality. And the government won't do anything about fiscal policy, won't raise taxes, and it won't stop war spending to protect the empire. And what you got left is austerity for social programs, and that's coming. Okay, I'm out of here.